forgiveness. I'd like to continue with this thought for a while, since a story that, everyone knows, David and Goliath. Goliath, the name they got right. David, a name they didn't get right. That's always interesting, isn't it? It really is Goliath. Which starts with the, that there's a harsh G sound that was eliminated from the oldest Hebrew alphabet to have two S sounds and two T's. The harsh G is the G that was used for Gaza, for Gomorrah, and for Goliath. And it speaks of all things associated with evil. And so he was this uncircumcised Philistine. By the way, when the statue of David that Michelangelo did, that is in
in Florence, right?
In Florence, yeah. You think he's circumcised or uncircumcised?
Nah, he was uncircumcised.
There you go. Yeah, religion. Okay. Religion's an amazing thing because, of course, this whole thing was commissioned by the religion of uncircumcision.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was Euphilistine, which it's a name that the Romans adopted to rename the province of Judea following the 133 Rabbi Akiva uprising after Hadrian lured them back into Israel with promises to rebuild the temple that the Romans had destroyed, only to say, oh, yeah, we're going to rebuild it, but we're going to rename the city after me. And the temple at the top is going to be a temple to me, with a statue of me in the center of it, along with Jupiter. He was an uncircumcised Philistine, that Goliath was, who was opposed to Yahweh. And yet Christians can't put the two together when Paul says twice that he was the messenger of uncircumcision. And a Roman, of the very people that would claim this moniker of Philistine to apply to the place that they were going to build a shrine to their emperor Hadrian. A very man that wrote on behalf of the religion of Rome in the book of Romans, 13th chapter, talking about how you ought to submit to religion because his God sanctions politics, sanctions governments. And yet when you read the story of and Shamuel, of the first king of the Israelis, boy, I mean, Yahweh goes on and on and on and on, talking about all the ways that a political ruler will deprive the people of their freedoms, of their rights, of their lives, of their property.
And it's us today. I mean, it's so, it's like reading the paper.
It is like reading the paper. And so a story that, we never thought much of. Why is this whole story of the rivalry between David and Saul, and then the fight between David and Goliath, why is it even presented? I mean, what is the purpose of it? And you find that it's all prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
Prophetic of the Torah versus Christianity, of the principal advocate for the Torah, David, in opposition to politics and to opposition to religion and in opposition to Paul, the founder of the Christian religion.
As king, Dode's major responsibility was just to protect, right? I mean, it was, they had courts. In the mm-hmm. sense that they have.
Oh, yeah.
He's not a king as we think of him as a ruler, and he didn't raise armies to go fight everybody and all that kind of stuff the way that Saul did.
David's view was that with Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
any one of us just relying on his guidance can defeat any foe, that we're not vulnerable to foes. And during a time where the Torah is being respected, Yahweh had the Kohen, the Lowi, that would have been corrupted to Levite, to not only demonstrate the symbolism of the Torah and its message, but also to adjudicate based upon the Torah's instructions. The Torah's got a marvelous economic system in it. It has a marvelous judicial basis in it. it has a marvelous sense of guidance and instruction of how a society should operate best in it. And so they were there to teach people and guide them and adjudicate between disputes on the basis of the Torah. It was the Constitution. But isn't it interesting that at this time, in these last days, less than 20 years between now and the time that the world as we know it ceases to exist, at this time where you're being called to choose whose side you want to be on, man's or God's, that at this time, one of the most important stories in the Torah, Prophets and Psalms, is being affirmed in vivid detail, brought to our attention. You know, it's like, Kirk, the other day I reported that in London they found an old manuscript of the Quran, and it happened to be the 18th chapter of the Quran that they found this reference to, and all the scholars were saying, you know, how wonderful this is. You know, it's a pretty accurate rendition of what they found previously. And of course, they found they dated the papyrus that it was written on, or the parchment that it was written on, not the calligraphy that was there. So, you know, they could be off by 200 years,
sure,
300 years. But what I said was, why didn't somebody look at what the 18th surah, since it's being affirmed here, why don't you look at what it says? And that's the surah that talks about Alexander the Great, the Al-Qarnayn, the two-horned, going to visit extraterrestrials and to want to torture extraterrestrials where the sun goes to bed at night in a muddy spring. And it is among the most ludicrous stories in the Quran, and its context of when it was given is so damning of Islam. And the other surah that it was part of, the 20th, is a grotesque corruption of the story of Moses. I mean, ridiculous, laughable.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, you know, 1,000 years after the story was chronicled, in a book that got all of history precisely accurate, in addition to all prophecy, you have this laughable corruption of the story of Moses that's being exposed in these manuscripts, and yet people aren't smart enough to speak out how damning this is to the religion of Islam, and are speaking instead of it being, well, this is gives it more credibility.
Well, they are smart enough to keep it hid. I mean, they don't address it. I mean, they're not stupid. I mean, they know where the bread is buttered.
I don't know. I think that a generation of academicians have been rendered so that they cannot exercise good judgment. That the scholars speaking of this were incapable of saying, you know, this is bad in a way. Yeah, it's good that here you got an old version of it. We really can't tell how old they dated the parchment, not the calligraphy, which was a stupid mistake. But what does it affirm? It affirms two of the most ridiculous lies in the Quran. It proves the Quran is false.
Mm-hmm.
Why
is it they always attack the Torah with science?
Right.
And they always use the English version where it doesn't make any sense because that's not what the Torah says.
Oh, they have to take it out of context, and they have to apply a religious interpretation to it
Nobody ever does that to the Quran.
Yeah, I know. And the funny thing is that in the Torah, in its creation accounts, they have to take a religious interpretation of the statements out of context and errantly translate it to have a straw man to oppose, because properly translated, the Hebrew of the creation account is precisely accurate. It's more accurate than the man is at the current time. And there's no disagreement on any of the things we know to be fact. Only disagreements on the things that are hypotheses that are not only unproven, but impossible in science. And so what you have here in the story of the Philistines, the story of Dod and Goliath, of the uncircumcised Philistine in opposition to God, you have one of the most important litmus tests, one of the most important lines drawn in the sand, one of the most important defining characterizations in the whole of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, particularly as it pertains to Pauline Christianity and him being the messenger of uncircumcision and the advocate of the Roman government in opposition to God. And Christians, not one will make that connection.
No.
Not one will say, wait a minute. This book that Paul discounted, that says, no, we have a New Testament now. We don't have to pay attention to that Old Testament. This book that Paul dismissed and called pornography is precisely accurate. It's the only precisely, universally accurate depiction of ancient history. And yet we're not going to afford it the credibility that it deserves? What does God have to do to get your attention?
Nobody, they don't care.
I don't care. I mean, you've been rendered incapable of caring. That's why I did that whole first section on the problem is that we don't care enough to hate. And if we really did care, we would hate.
Absolutely.
We should be disgusted that academically, that politically, that in the media, that we are being misled, that we are being indoctrinated, that we're being led astray by unthinking, unwitting individuals. And it's our own damn fault.
Yeah, there's no letters to the editor. There's no groundswell.
No.
Against it. There's no one on the news.
No.
Here, this stuff to say something. Say, wait a minute. What is this?
What does this mean? What is the consequence of this? I mean, here they just say an archaeological expedition has discovered the fortifications of the entrance gate, and they say biblical, lowercase b. Mm-hmm. It's not biblical. There is no book called the Bible.
No.
Not from God's point of view. It's the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. If you don't believe me, why don't you listen to Yosha's elucidation on it?
Mm-hmm.
Does he ever refer to it as a Bible?
No.
No. What does he refer to it as? The Torah. The Torah and Prophets, and the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. But even when he refers to it as the Torah and Prophets, and Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, it's a singular thing.
Yeah.
In other words, the Torah teaching and guidance exists throughout the prophetic books. All of the books are prophetic because that's his signature, and they're all writings, which is what Psalms means.
Almost every word out of his mouth.
Yes. Every time he talks, he's affirming something in it. He's quoting it, and he refers to it as the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It's not a Bible. Why would they use the term Bible? It's wrong. It is fascinating to me that in this particular find, that they found a city named Gath, which is the exact name that Yahweh applies to it, that the city was Philistine, exactly as Yahweh said it was, that it was home to Goliath, as the inscriptions declare, that it was the largest city in the land at the time. And guess when they date this city to?
I'm sure it's exactly the same.
Yeah, you know when Dode laid the foundation materials for the Yahweh's temple on Mount Moriah?
Well, it's got to be around the 700 mark, doesn't it?
Nope. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Very important date. Extraordinarily important date. 967 BCE.
Yeah.
Now, why is that an important date?
That's one of the seven marks.
Yeah. I mean, Adam and Chawa were booted out of Eden, a place that we've located. I mean, it's easy to find to know where Eden was located. God gives you an exact depiction of where it was, Thunder Lake Ban now in eastern Turkey. Yahweh booted them out in 3967 BCE. 1,000 years later, we have proof based upon the change of fresh to salt water in the Dead Sea, the opening of the Bosphorus Strait, and the sediments that were spewing up from the impact of the Burkle crater, where a meteor struck the Earth, an asteroid struck the Earth at 2967 BCE. absolute proof of that story, which is not mythical either.
No, they didn't bring it up the other day in the story on the news about the asteroids. They did a whole show on asteroids, and they just
it's one of the largest and one of the best documented impact craters in the world, the Birkel impact crater that was started on the flood in exactly the manner that Yahweh described, of a welling up of deep seawater. For Yahweh's instructions. And then you move forward to the second most important date and year in history of the Torah prophets and Psalms. And that would be 1968 BCE. 1968 BCE on Yahweh's calendar is year 2000, 2,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden, because the whole story is there's 6,000 years where we move away from the garden, and in the seventh year, the 7,000 year, we're right back to it. We're brought back in. And so year 2000 is when Yahweh asks Abraham, his partner in the covenant, to take his firstborn son, Yishak, Laughter, to Mount Moriah, where every aspect, every detail of that story is a dress rehearsal for what Yahweh will do with his son, Yosha. Exactly 2,000 years, 40 Yobel later, in 33 CE. And so the difference between 1967 BCE and 33 CE is exactly 2,000 years, because there was no zero when they changed from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian. So here we are now. Was there an incident that took place that is meaningful, that confirms all of this dating, that would define what occurred that would be meaningful from Yahweh's perspective between 1968 BCE or 1967 BCE and 33 CE?
I don't think the Moed Mikris are pretty big.
Well, that would be in year 4000, that's in 33 CE. What about between those dates? That gets to the exact day that Dode made all the materials available and the cornerstone was laid for the temple. 968 BCE. It's a date that is etched in stone. It was year 3000 Yah. This ruin, this city of the Philistines, the home of Goliath, was found dating to the 10th century BCE, to 967.
Really?
BCE.
Amazing.
Okay, there you go. How many affirmations do you need?
Well, that'll do it. That's more than Dr. Levy ever had. He came up with Lucy.
Yeah, they said that here that it was not only the 10th century of BCE, about the time of the United Kingdom of Israel. King Ahab of Israel. No. The first king of Israel was Saul, a story that should trouble and haunt Christians today. The second was Dode. That's when he was king. Kirk, I was remiss in doing something that I would like to return to, just because there are very few things that are as important as knowing this.
Okay.
Well, I went to the history because I asked you a question. I asked you the question of when did the city of Goliath, Gath, the ruins of this massive Philistine city that's described in such detail in the book of Samuel, the prophet. When did the archaeological discovery date the city to, the 10th century? So I asked you, what was the timing? And the answer is 967 BCE. And so to get there, I began by saying that if you look at the chronologies that are provided in the Torah, what you find is that Adam and Chawa were booted out of Eden, a place that we know exactly where it was because Yahweh provided a detailed map so that we could locate it.
Mm-hmm.
And 3967 BCE. And that 1,000 years later, in year 1000 Yah, is when we have absolute proof from the transformation of clear to salt water in the Dead Sea, in the Black Sea, along with the rise of 500 feet of water over the civilizations that were surrounding the Black Sea, as well as all the sediment that came up the Tigris and Euphrates River as a result of the Burkle impact crater, dating to year 1000 Yah, 2967 BC.
2967,
In exactly the manner Yahweh described, with a welling up of salt water beginning the flood. And exactly the place that Yahweh said that he wiped out all but eight individuals with a nesalma, a conscience, which is really essential, particularly today, because what part of our human nature are we not exercising as a people because of political correctness?
Our brain.
Yeah, our conscience.
Our practice, yeah.
Yeah. People have consciousness. They can react to what they're witnessing. But they're not capable anymore, or not willing to contemplate it, to express moral outrage at things that are wrong, evil, deadly, destructive, counterproductive, hurtful. They're not exercising their conscience, which is the seat of moral judgment. And that's Yahweh wiped out the humans apart from eight in that region by his own testimony with that flood, 2968 BCE, year 1000 Yah. Year 2000 Yah is maybe the, and I would say of history thus far, is the second most important time in human history. Exactly 40 Yobel. 40 is the time of the completion of a period of testing. And Yobel are seven Sabbaths plus 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So 50 years. 40 times 50 is 2,000. That's 40 Yobel. But 20 Yobel after the flood. 40 Yobel after being booted from the Garden of Eden, Yahweh came up with the plan and the provision to allow us to come back to Eden, to share an eternity with him in the conditions that it were experienced in Eden. And that was the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And the covenant was affirmed on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, before Jerusalem was even a city, but on Mount Moriah, exactly on year 2000 Yah, 1967 BCE, year 2000 Yah, with Abraham and with Yitzhak and with the ram that was caught in the thickets and Yahweh. So, right. And then 1,000 years later, we know in year 3000 Yah that the cornerstone of the temple was established. 967 BCE. So what happened 1,000 years thereafter in year 4000 Yah? That would be 33 CE.
Now we're coming to the Mikra, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's the Mikra.
Jumped ahead
and left. Yeah, and that's the single most important 3 days in human history, and even four, if you want to count Shavuot, and I would. The four most important days in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all fulfilled in the fourth day when Yahweh told us that the greater light would become visible to us as a sign for the meetings, the Moed. Well, the Moed Mikre were fulfilled in year 4000 Yah, exactly when Yahweh said they would in the fourth day of creation. And the first four Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavua, the means to eternal life, the means to be made perfect, the means to be adopted into Yahweh's family, the means to be empowered and enriched by him, the five benefits of the covenant, were all enabled on Mount Moriah exactly 2,000 years after the covenant was affirmed with Abraham, and exactly the same spot, and 1,000 years after Dode laid the foundation for the temple. In 33 CE, with Yosha walking into Jerusalem 4 days before Passover, exactly as Daniel had predicted over 500 years earlier. Does it sound like a plan to you?
Pretty. The first time I read it, it was, wow, my gosh.
Yeah, that was all that I needed.
Wow, we. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was all that I needed to know for certain that Yahweh is in fact God, and that he inspired this testimony. That's riveting. If you're a rational person, that's riveting testimony. It's conclusive testimony. And then what happened 1,000 years later? And
poisoned the temple. And,
right. The water underneath the temple was poisoned because the test for infidelity, because there's nothing that is a product of infidelity that is greater than Roman Catholicism and Christianity. The test for infidelity, according to the In the Wilderness, Bob Midbar, Numbers 5, is a poisoning of the water beneath the temple. That's what happened. And so what's going to happen? 40 Yobel, 2,000 years from 33 CE. Year 6,000, yeah.
Then we're going to conclude this thing.
We are. There are.
And we have three more Mikrais to go.
We have three more Mikrais to go. The first of those that is unfulfilled, because he's fulfilled the first four. All four were fulfilled in year 4,000 Yah, because they represent the means for Yahweh to justifiably, honestly, dependably, justly deliver the five benefits of the covenant. The fifth of those Moed Mikrais is going to be fulfilled sometime, between now and the time of the tribulation begins. The tribulation began in 2026. In the fall of 2026, probably that same year, although it could be any Teruah between now and then, but probably in that same year on Teruah.
Well, he won't take the voice. I agree with you. He won't take the voices out until he's given everybody as much chance as possible.
I think so, too. It's just his nature. It's just his nature. I expect to be able to be here for the next 11 years. And during that time, we will continue to act out on the purpose, the mission of Teruah, which is to sound an alarm and to blow Yah's trumpet so that we show people the way. That's Teruah. But then the next two. The day of reconciliations will be fulfilled when Yahweh reconciles his relationship with Yisrael and Yehudim, just as it's chronicled in Yirmiyah 31, the basis of the reaffirmation of the covenant, where he will place his Torah inside of his children. That will occur in year 6000 Yah, on the day of reconciliations, the very day that he said he would return. If you're looking at your pagan Roman Catholic calendar, that says the sun sets on a Monday, October 2nd, 2033. You don't want to be there when this occurs, not as a mortal.
No. You know, even as a Christian, I knew exactly, because we had done studies on when, in Daniel, when Yahusha would show up. And if it was that precise in the Torah when he would show up then, it was absurd to think that he wouldn't tell you when he's going to show up the next time. So there was never an argument. It was never an argument.
No.
My thing on this thing about, well, no one knows the time and place. And of course, we've dispelled that.
He was actually,
that 100 times.
He was actually in Hebrew. He was citing Zechariah. He was telling us exactly the day that he was going to show up. It's the one essential day, the only day, a day that is known to the Father. And he was actually the entire Olivet discourse, as it relates to the timing, is a citation of Zechariah, of Zechariah, which means to remember Yah. And he told us the exact day he was going to come. It's just that when Hebrew got translated into Greek and then twisted by the religious establishment, it became a nonsensical statement, a statement that is so nonsense that if it were true, then Yahusha was not.
He certainly couldn't have the set apart spirit.
No.
On him. I mean, like she don't know.
Yeah, right. And so he was telling you when he was going to return. He was actually citing Zechariah. Zechariah is one of the most vivid prophetic portrayals of this most important day in history, of the day that he's going to return, of Yom Kippur, 5 days before Sukkah, which means camping out with God, which is the beginning of the thousand-year celebration of Sukkah, the thousand-year celebration of the Shabbat, Sukkah being the seventh and final Moed Mikrei, where we camp out with God, where God camps out with us, where he's going to establish the entire earth like it was in the Garden of Eden. We come home. And if you read that story and you consider each of these meetings along the way and what they represent, and how Yahweh is performing on his promises and drawing those of us who listen to him, who observe his guidance, home, and enabling us to be adopted into his family and live with him on these specific dates. It's one of the most enlightening stories in the universe. It's the path home.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is a lot to this. And for, you know, you just had another affirmation of a of another archaeological spade affirming this very timing as it goes back in history. Because from Yahweh's perspective, the past, present, and future are all the same. Yahweh has witnessed our future.
Mm-hmm.
He was there in our past. And so he's laid out this tapestry of his interaction in human history, also that we would know him, so that he could prove that he exists, so that he could prove that we could trust him, so that we could come to know him, and so that we would view as credible, as important, the testimony that he has proven and that he inspired in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. That's why this story is important. Every detail of the city of Gath was as Yahweh described. There was even an iron foundry there, describing how the Philistines were better armed than the Israelis. And, of course, there were temples to all manner of pagan gods that they have unearthed there, all consistent with the details that Yahweh has provided. We have also Glenn with us, Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
What's your impression of all of this, Glenn?
Hello, Yada. Hello, Kirk. It's fascinating stuff. It's interesting. There's this polarity about the historical accuracy of, you know, Old Testament dating and locations and stuff. And like you say, for people who are listening and paying attention to recent discoveries, there is all of this, you know, Bible-affirming studies discoveries coming out. But it's amazing how bullheaded some people can be. They, you know, I mean, I know of people who insist, oh, it's all fraudulent, it's all cockamamie, and none of it's true, and none of this is, and they just state this without, you know, apparently looking at any of the scholarship or the stuff that's going on in the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah. Right? There's a book written by David Rolfe called A Test of Time that details the archaeological finds pertaining to Goshen and the Israeli captivity there, and every detail of the story. Every detail of the story is affirmed. And it actually dates the pharaoh under whom the Israelites were captive, and it wasn't Ramses, and the Torah and prophets never say that it was Ramses. The Torah says that they were in a city named after the sun god, Ramses. And of course it provides it in Hebrew, which is a phonetic language, that the name of the Egyptian god was, Ra, what, 3,500 years before, we figured out how to pronounce the language via the Rosetta Stone. That it was right there in the Torah. And no one gives the Torah, wait a minute, wasn't that pretty interesting that the Torah gives that credibility? No, they artificially say because it was the city of Ramses, which was the name of the god, that Pharaoh must have been Ramses, and therefore the timeline doesn't work. Well, the timeline is precisely accurate. It never says that the Pharaoh at the time was Ramses, right. Just that he was Pharaoh.
Well, Ramses is actually Ra Moses, or Ramses, the son of Ra. Yeah, Moses is just son.
Right.
Moses could preferably be named Yamses.
Right. Yeah, the son of Ramses just means the son of Ra. He was presenting himself as the son of the sun, as was the case of almost all pagan religions and political schemes.
Right.
But every aspect of it is dated and accurately dated, and yet you were right that. Scholars want to put their heads in the sand and pretend to be enlightened by saying that it's not true and just ignoring all the evidence to the contrary.
Oh, and especially big mouth pundits. I mean, it's amazing. But anyway, About the calendrical dates, the dating of these things, you talk about 1967, BC being, I think you said 4,000, about the dating of the calendar for these dates for, you're saying,
The 1967 BCE would be year 2000,
Right, 2000, I'm sorry,
4,000, would be 33 CE of our pagan calendars.
And that's precisely what I'm getting at. These types of things are the kind of things you have to repeat and rehearse, and we are memorizing things for tests and school dates and everything. And it takes a while to get the system figured out. Now, for example, I believe this is the year 5775 in the current Jewish calendar, right?
Right. The issue is that in the Masoretic text, which was created while the Hebrews were in Babylon, the Masoretic text is timed to about the 10th century CE. So the remnant of the Israelites in Babylon created the Babylonian Talmud, and then later the Masoretic text. They read the old numbering systems for the 10th place, which was a horizontal line over the numbers, incorrectly, or that the line in the numbers and the copies that they had faded with the line over these numbers, and therefore they're off a number of places in the 10th place in the Masoretic text. All of those numbers are actually corrected in the Septuagint, which was a translation of much older manuscripts than formed the basis of the Masoretic text. And so if you compare the dating system that is found in the Septuagint for the intervening numbers of years, that's why you'll find the error. But religious Jews are committed to their Masoretic text, and you won't get them to change, even though the Septuagint says that they're in error.
Wow, land of Goshen.
Land of Goshen.